Hello, welcome. You're all logging in now, so we're just gonna wait a little bit for all of you to access the room. I hope you are all having a great day, and I will continue to speak in English for this whole event because I know there are some English-speaking participants today. If you have any problems connecting, then you can look into the chat and see Catherine's comments there. If you have any problems with the sound, you can also chat with Catherine if you have any questions. So there are still some people logging on, so we're just going to wait a little bit. And if you are not seeing me on your full screen right now, you can switch to speaker view from gallery view. All right, the last people are logging in and then we will start. Hopefully, none of you have any technical problems, but if you do, you can ask Catherine in the chat. All right, super. We are going to start now. So, hello and welcome to the second So Talk in this series in the new economy, or the nye samfunnsøkonomien, for those of you who speak Norwegian. My name is Sofie Furu, and I come from So Central, who hosts these So Talk series. And what we want to do is to take big, complex challenges and break them into smaller concrete examples, exploring new solutions and encouraging cross-sector collaboration. If you're curious about what we do or interested in becoming a member of our Nordic Incubator for Social Innovation, check out socentral.no. And I just want to mention that today's event is being recorded, but none of your names or videos will be a part of the recording. And if you have any questions to our speaker, Danny, today, then you can write them in the chat and we will read them up for him as we go on and at the end of the event. And your name and your video will not be on the recording then either. We are geared to see acceleration and growth as good and slowdowns and deceleration as bad. And today we're going to dive into the slowdown and see if our notion about everything around us actually is in constant acceleration. And if it's not, whether this is as bad as we might have thought. And today we have Professor of Human Geography at Oxford, Danny Dorling, with us, who just published his new book, Slowdown, The End of the Great Acceleration, and Why It's Good for the Planet, the Economy, and Our Lives. And here, Dorling argues that human life has been slowing down in most areas since the early 1770s, and that the deceleration might be a good opportunity to embrace the slowdown that will benefit people, the economy, and the planet. So thank you for taking time to be with us here today, Danny. And in your book, you argue that the acceleration stopped in the 70s, and that we now have an experience based on growth and mechanisms that makes us believe that we're still in a high growth phase, even though we're not. Could you tell us a little bit more about this, Danny?
Yes, I'm very happy to, and thank you ever so much for inviting me. This book wasn't originally called Slowdown. I began writing this book about 6 or now 7 years ago, and I meant to write a book about that half of human life, half of human activity, which was speeding up, and that half which was slowing down, and see what we could learn from that, because we were beginning to get better and better quality data, which allows you to look at the rate of change and the rate of change in the rate of change. It was going to be a very nerdy book. It is quite a nerdy book. It has 67 quite complicated diagrams in it. About 2 or 3 years into working on it, I began to realize that I wasn't finding things that were speeding up. Hardly anything was speeding up. A lot of things in human life were still rising. Our numbers on the planet is rising. Our GDP is still rising, but not as fast as it had been before. And I basically came to the conclusion that we have been living through a period of acceleration. Our parents and grandparents in particular saw incredible change. I'm old enough that my grandparents, two of them, were born before the tractor was invented. So when they were babies, there were no tractors, there were just horses in fields. And in their lifetimes, they saw the tractor, they saw the car, they saw the first aeroplane, and they saw a moonshot. And they saw computers everywhere before they died. That's an incredible acceleration. I haven't seen anything like that in my life. And if you measure the rate of change in innovation, some people claim that actually the 1930s were the time of the biggest increase in the inventions that really made a big difference. But we have a culture where we talk about things speeding up because for our parents and grandparents, they did. If you take population, globally in the world, the highest rate of population growth of the species ever was around about 1968, 2% growth per year, which is why the population bomb book was written and why people thought we're going to get mass starvation in the planet. That slowed 1969, 1970, 71. It's currently just around about 1% per year, and it's heading towards zero within the lifetime of small children alive today. That's the first stability of the species on the planet. That began in 1968. Or take GDP growth worldwide. The fastest rate of GDP growth was in the 1950s, less on average in the 60s, less in the 70s, less in the 80s. So many things. Big data, you know, you think big data, yes, it's going up. It's not as fast as it was going up in the past. So it was a reality check for me. It was a reality check of I had got something fundamentally wrong. I had thought that some things were changing at an incredible rate, and they weren't. And I should just say by saying what things were still accelerating, the small number of things that were still accelerating, they're very important. University graduates were accelerating worldwide. We weren't just getting more each year, we were getting a bigger increase than the year before. That's just the percentage of young adults in the world. However, you kind of knew that that was going to have to stop because you can't get beyond 100% of young adults going to university. So there are accelerations where you can tell you're living in an interesting time. And then the other things that were accelerating were things like how many flights were being taken worldwide, only by a small number of people, but, you know, a year or so ago, 4 billion passengers flying in the world, many of the same people flying again and again. And the number of flights wasn't just going up, it was going up faster than the year before every year. Pollution, carbon pollution, was doubling every 22, 23 years. I could say was now because of the pandemic we're in, but that showed almost no sign of slowing down. That was an incredible acceleration. And it's odd that while everything else was slowing, we were still consuming more and more each year. And lastly, of course, surface temperature of the planet. Not just going up each year on average, but on average now going up slightly more, the increase being slightly more than the year before. That's terrifying. That's why climate change matters. So, you know, the book isn't saying that everything you thought you knew was wrong. It's saying that some things you thought you knew were a problem are an incredible problem. But don't think that the rate of change has never been faster than it is now. Because the minute you begin to measure it, you find it isn't. And I should just end on one anecdote in case I forget to say this, because you're the right audience for this anecdote. I've read lots of books by social scientists written mainly 10 or 15 years ago about acceleration and about how things are going faster than ever before. And what I noticed is that they very rarely had actual examples in. They're often very theoretical with long words, referencing French philosophers and so on. And one book in particular I really enjoyed, you had to go through about 7 or 8 pages of the introduction before you came across an example of what they meant by acceleration. And here's the example. And you have to think, how much did they look for an example before they found this one? And the example was the speed at which politicians speak in the Norwegian parliament. and they found it had doubled over 50 years. Now, the fact that books about acceleration find it so hard to find any actual evidence of acceleration, you know, that should tell you we were collectively getting things wrong because we so much believed we were accelerating that we didn't stop and see whether it really was the case. We've been slowing for decades in various ways, at various speeds, but we should now begin to accept this slowdown is systemic. It's not due to individual events. It's not due to an oil crisis in the 70s or unemployment in the 80s. Individual events matter, but when you step back and look, you can see that something bigger is going on. Thank you for letting me introduce that.
Thank you. So why do you think that everyone is communicating then that we are accelerating?
Because beliefs about how the world is are not changed that quickly. We inherit them from our teachers. And of course, we inherit them from our parents. They inherit them from their parents. And if something has been true for a very long time, and in a way, the population acceleration was true from the 1820s onwards, if in living memory, in the living memory of your grandparents, and often their grandparents if you're European, everything has been changing, then that becomes the norm. Speeding forward is normal. And you see any slowdown as just a temporary aberration. Oh, don't worry, it'll grow again. Or we must worry about population growth, because although fertility is really, really low now, you never know, it could rise again. It's a normal way to think. It's safe not to assume that something fundamentally is changing. I should also say, the evidence only becomes really kind of clear in the last 10 years. That's when, and again, population is key to this, it's in the last 10 years that fertility doesn't just fall, it begins to plummet and fastest in the countries in which it's highest. It's in the last 10 years that we can kind of say, admittedly with a global financial crash, but we can say, look, economic growth overall is slowing down, even slowing in China before the current events. And as I would argue, and this may be more controversial, it's in the last 10 years where I think we can say we're not seeing the formation of new social movements. For me, the last kind of big rise in social movements was the 70s, when a lot of green parties and environmental groups were formed in the 70s. You could look at the 80s and 90s, the first decade of this millennium, and now the second, and say, what really compares to that? So I think we have a slowdown in political thought as well. But it doesn't depress me. I think we get better at using the ideas that we generated. And why should that be? Why should there be a slowdown in political thought? Because the world isn't changing as much as it was changing before. We got green movements in the 70s because we had a huge environmental problem, which is something that we hadn't had 100 years before then.
Also, I just want to bring up one of the comments that we have gotten from one of our participants, Rosanna, who says that this is a very interesting subject and a bit ironic that we have to make a real effort to clear our schedule to be able to attend this slowdown event.
Yes.
And that brings me to, I thought that you just published this book right in the middle of the Corona lockdown. When a lot of people has experienced the slowdown firsthand in very concrete terms, yeah. As we all had to literally slow down or stop completely. Now, what can we hope to learn from this pandemic? And how do you think this crisis can amplify the possibilities of a slowdown future?
We should hopefully learn a lot from this pandemic. However, the slowdown book actually has details of past pandemics in it, and we didn't learn from them. The one I concentrate most on the book is the 1918-19 flu, where global GDP fell by 14%, also, of course, because of a war in Europe, only in Europe, but still, revolution in Russia and so on. Global GDP fell by 14% in 1918. It then rose by 16% the next year, bounced back completely. The same is true, and even more true, of pandemics which were smaller than 1918, but so far bigger than this one. And these are pandemics you almost certainly won't know about, which shows how much we ignored them. It's the 1951 global influenza pandemic, 1957 influenza pandemic, and the 1968-69, which came back in 1772. More people died worldwide, far more people, despite the fact that the planet had fewer people on it and we were younger in 1968-1969. And did it dent economic growth? Did it change anything? No. So you have to be wary. However, our reaction to this pandemic has been utterly different. You can always find historical parallels. The parallel is cholera, if you want. Diseases that can affect the very affluent get a different reaction. That's all I'll say on this. Often socially very useful. With cholera, the affluent funded or agreed to allow the building of sewer systems, not because they cared about the rest of society, they worried about themselves. This pandemic has brought an actual slowdown into clear focus. The shock is, it's for us most, well, many things have shocked us, but one is, of course, it has slowed down the few things which were accelerating, completely slowed down flights for now, but hopefully longer, because there will be fewer companies that are flying. The cost of flying should be higher because there are fewer. And also lots of people will be fearful of flying. You know, and also question, do you really need to take that flight? We should expect for some time GDP growth to be affected by this. We shouldn't expect a sudden bounce back as in the past, because we only got a bounce back in the past by almost completely ignoring the pandemics and letting the old die. Which we haven't done. We should expect an effect on our consumption, not least because of our economies affected, but also we'll begin to question, what do you really need to consume? Do you really need to buy more and more material goods? Or do things like food become more important to you, what actually makes you happy and the security of it? And the last one, which of course really affects people like me and maybe some of you, universities. You know, that global market, terrible thing, it was a market, the global market in moving affluent young people around the planet, and particularly in charging them very high fees to go to my country or the United States and so on. You know, if you were going to puncture that particular acceleration which we were in, this may do it more than ever. The danger, though, the big, big danger, and it may sound strange when you're still in the middle of the pandemic to say it, so try and remember this in future. The huge danger is that a year from now, this was a historical event that you lived through. That is receding into memory. That's the big danger. If you want to avoid that danger, apart from anything else, just remember pandemics are random. They don't come every 100 years. Their chance of coming every year is 1 in 100. So keep the fear that you have now and use it to prepare for the next one.
So what about relations and families and values? Do you think we will see any effect on that?
This is where I get much more speculative, because one criticism you get when you say everything is slowing down is that, oh, you're writing an end of history book. You're sort of saying it'll always be like this. So I tried at the end of the book to look for what things that we don't measure are speeding up. Because of course the things that we measure are things that mattered to us and often mattered to us for quite a long time. So in a way, it's not surprising that what we measure slows down because of what it is. I end looking at human relationships, and particularly in Japan, because Japan is one of the countries in the world that slowed down the most, that slowed down earliest. We used to call it a long time ago that Japan had a lost decade. Then we said two lost decades, then we said three lost decades. And then we say, oh, hold it, look, Japan has the highest life expectancy of any large country in the world. Actually much higher, 8 years higher for women than men. Japan has very low crime. Japan isn't actually doing that badly. And of course, Japan, as most equitable nations in the world, is quite good at dealing with a pandemic. I'm waiting for people to begin to look at the connection between that. It's good at social organization. So is Japan getting really boring? Is nothing happening in Japan? Well, when you look at Japan, you see that social relations are changing faster than before. Issues of hierarchy, where you fit. I am with the royal family, which for the first time in, I think it's 2.5, possibly 3 millennia, have a commoner in the family and a child going to a school you wouldn't normally go, who's going to be the emperor. But also you look at social relations of young people, how that changes what they can do. And so the kind of speeding up or the accelerations that I see are in identity, what you can be, who you can be with. How are people reacting to you when you say, this is my partner? How do people react to you when you say, this is how I live my life? And we should expect an acceleration of change in social relations at the same time as other things slow down, partly because it makes it more possible when you have greater stability, I think, to be less fearful and not have to conform as much as people felt they needed to in the past when things were hurtling forward.
Great. And then we have another question from the chat asking that, so the degrowth movement and others argue that we need to move from growth to development, that is increased quality rather than quantity. Do you think that is already happening in the slowdown, and how would you evaluate that?
I think it's, if you simply look at the average change in GDP per decade, particularly for countries with the highest GDP, you can see that the growth is less each time. I'll give you a concrete example. If you look at waste in England, my generation, I'm 52, my generation, we throw away each week 6 times as much in waste as our parents did on average. So when I grew up and I was a child, we had a small metal bin, and I grew up in a household of 6 people, and we would fill the small metal bin every week. Now I have 3 bins which are plastic and twice the volume of that bin. And okay, one's for gardening waste and one's for recyclables and so on. But the actual volume of waste coming out of my house is 6 times bigger, and I am normal. That is not going to happen again. We're not going to have 36 in a grit bins. So the degrowth has already begun. I think it is perfectly acceptable to say that 0% GDP growth or even 0.5% falls can accompany a much improved standard of living for most people. And that is often disliked by economists who then say, no, you need growth to help the poor. The United States provides by far the best example of why growth just on its own doesn't help most people. The large majority of GDP growth in the United States in the last 50 years has been taken by the top 10%, top 1%. Half the population of the United States have seen themselves materially be in a worse position over time. But I don't know. I think we could do with a different language than degrowth and so on. We could simply say you get to a point where you have enough, and then you have to work out what is it which is making people happy and unhappy and content. And it is no longer being able to heat your home because you can now do that. It is no longer getting things which are necessities. But there are still anxieties which are just as strong in people's lives when the material needs are met.
Exactly. And drawing on that inequality aspect, how do you think the slowdown will affect the distribution of wealth and income?
This is why I'm sort of being partly hopeful. I look at OECD measures of inequality. And if you look at OECD measures of income inequality, you actually see that they have been falling in the majority of OECD countries for most of the last 10 years. It's not often said. Whenever inequality rises, people point it out and say it's terrible, but we don't notice that there can be falls. Oh, we're currently potentially in an era of incredible wealth distribution, by the way. Billionaires losing $1.5 billion in the last 2 months. Anyway, don't get your hopes up too high, but and of course, if you have no wealth, which majority of people in rich countries don't have any wealth, the reduction of wealth, the evaporation of share value into the ether doesn't affect you. When we had great acceleration, it was possible to make an argument to people that said, don't worry about the situation you're in. In fact, even don't worry about the fact that a small number of people have a huge amount, because they're going to be wealth creators and they're going to make more wealth for you, and then you'll be okay in future, or at least your children will be. And that was an argument that sort of sounded plausible when things were zooming ahead. But as soon as you see that the size of the cake is not getting much bigger and the rate of increase in that cake is slowing and slowing, and of course the cake may even get smaller, how you share the cake out becomes crucially important, because promises of cake to come don't work anymore. I see the slowdown as being potentially very closely linked to a reduction in inequalities. And also, we're at a kind of inequality a few years ago high. It varies dramatically across the rich world now. Everywhere was unbelievably unequal in 1920, very similar. Today, as you're probably absolutely tired of hearing, you in Norway are at one extreme, I in England are at the other extreme. If you were in England right now and you became sick, you would be on the equivalent of about 15 euros a day to live off. That's our benefits, 15 euros. And people here, of course, in this country, don't know that in much of the rest of Europe, the situation is very different.
Yeah, and I believe there are some international participants here today, so there might be some other countries that are agreeing a lot with you there. And previously, you talked about how the last big disruptive innovations being in the 70s, such as the cell phone and the PCs. Now, disruptive innovations does not have to be new technological devices to be disruptive. Disruption can come from, just playing the game differently. And what type of disruptive innovations do you think our society needs now?
It certainly can. And this is my hope. I've measured slowdown in things we conventionally measure, but what we wish for is change. And if you're at all progressive, you wish for change in other ways. And the obvious one to say, of course, is the schools movement on the environment, school strikes, and so on. We have not seen anything like it. It had never occurred before outside a few months in Greece, when the generals were taking over in the dictatorship. But other than very rare events around the world, Soweto, South Africa now comes to mind. But yeah, school strikes were a very rare thing that occurred in countries with intense political difficulties. And then suddenly school strikes became a thing that occurred around the world. That's a disruption in the way of doing things differently. It's also about how you treat and see other people. While you're moving forward at an incredible rate, while say there's a middle class that is growing, it can make a lot of sense for you to desperately try to get into that middle class. Then you'll be okay. Step over other people. But while you see a situation in which changing future isn't going to be that great, there isn't a group that you can join and then you'll be okay because you'll be in the accelerating group. You have to think about how you get on with other human beings a bit more. And that creates a disruption when people aren't willing to countenance particular ways of behaving as much as they were in the past. Now, that may sound a bit vague, but I notice it more and more in terms of what can be said or argued easily, and then what is questioned. And I think it's the social relationships between ourselves where we should expect to see the acceleration of change. We have lived in quite similar nuclear families with quite a degree of separation, politeness, quietness, rules of deference, that kind of kept us sheltered at a time of acceleration. People have sometimes described families, and this is a nice way of looking at families because not all families are happy, but families as kind of small socialist institutions in which you all share and look after each other. And it's a kind of safety net against the outside world where you have no idea what's going to happen. Now, as you get a better idea of what's happening in the outside world, and of course, as we get many more smaller families, families with no children, or families with one child being more common than families with two, interactions outside the family become much more important. Whereas larger families in the past, it was less. But that's where the change will be happening. We have some evidence of it in the numbers. The number of people choosing to live alone is just rising and rising and rising when they can. Something people just simply wouldn't have thought would happen. It turns out far more people are happier in normal times. The pandemic is interesting. Living on your own can be great until you're told you've got to just be on your own. Those are the areas. And of course, there'll be other areas. I should really say this, you know, I'm doing a lot of guessing here, but I do know, because it's not hard to tell, I do know that the biggest changes that will come, even in 10 or 20 years, will be things that I have not imagined at all. You know, it's quite easy to look back over history and see that social scientists and professors actually miss more things than they correctly guess at.
Yeah, and I mean, we have a little joke here in Norway that we're looking forward to the social distancing to end so that we can go back to having 4 meters distance between us.
Yes.
And we talked a little bit about this before, Danny, but since 2007, there's a house in an area here in Oslo called Vålerenga, which has been part of the city ecological pilot project in collaboration with the municipality of Oslo, where 20 people are sharing 2 showers and 1 washing machine, and they grow, you know, food in the garden. And the goal of the project is to see if people can lower their costs and consumption while still increasing the standard of living. So they don't throw away their clothes. Instead, they go to other people in the building. And finding a babysitter is, of course, the easiest thing, as the community is quite tight. Now, during the shutdown, many people, like you said, especially the ones living alone in these big houses, have reflected on the resilience of our societies and also the resilience of our core family. What do you think the coronavirus can teach us about the way we organize our communities?
Well, I mean, one of the saddest things for me in my work is seeing, you can see the faces of your colleagues in meetings. And my colleagues who have babies, 1-year-olds, 2-year-olds, and 3-year-olds, you can see it in their face. In fact, we've had weeks of people being locked up. And already, of course, before that, you know, anybody who had children knew a small child hates being alone. Children are programmed to cry as soon as they think they've been left by the hunter-gatherers walking away. You know, if you ever wondered why a baby's cry pierces your ears so much, it's evolutionary. You're designed not to ignore them. And small children are very happy when there are other small children around. And so we have this ridiculous thing of bringing our children up in this kind of isolation, in this private, I think it's almost a kind of horror, sort of solitary confinement for a child, apart from some adults who aren't really that much fun. But for decade after decade, nothing much happened. People tried experiments, they tried communes, they broke down. This doesn't mean it won't change. You've got these experiments going on, but I also think this particular experience might help. They're often very rare. Like, it's interesting you talk about the one in Oslo. In Britain, the one we talk about always is Lilac, which is one in Leeds, which is about 2 dozen apartments set up to be environmental. And one of my best friends actually helped set it up. And there's a lovely story, which is public, which I can tell you about it. One day he was in the communal garden and he had a stroke. He's quite young, younger than me. He had a stroke, and a stroke which could have killed him. But luckily, because it was a communal garden, his neighbours were in the garden. And they put him in a wheelbarrow and they wheelbarrowed into the road and they called an ambulance. Now, if he had had the standard British house with your own little garden with fences around it, he'd be dead now. It's an extreme example of the kind of the changes that will come as people begin to see that it makes sense to learn to share a bit more. But I do think we should look back and say, what was strange? And we should say, actually, the period of acceleration was strange. Before that period of acceleration, the vast majority of human beings in rich countries like ours lived in villages. And there was a degree of sharing that occurred in the villages, a degree of sharing of where children went and who they could be with, which disappeared as we moved into cities. And the cities were scary, and we began to imprison ourselves more and more. So one great danger is because we've just lived through the biggest acceleration in the history of our species, the only time ever when within 6 or 7 generations, it doubled from 1 billion to 2, doubled again to 4, doubled again to almost 8, double. Never happened before in a short time, can never happen again. What was going on during that really weird period was not normal. But as far as we're concerned, that's normal. New ways of living will approach a new kind of normality, and they might show some echoes of that more stable past. And the stable past are very different around the world, but they were all disrupted about 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And before this talk, we spoke, and I brought up a question on your thoughts about the lack of investment and preventive efforts in children and the young in our current models. Mm-hmm. And you said this might be changing due to demographic changes. Could you elaborate a little bit on this?
Yeah, children change in how valuable we see them, partly in terms of how many there are. People have always cared about children. There's a lovely book called Children Remembered, which looks at the reaction of people 300, 400, 500 years ago to the death of a child. When the death of a child was incredibly normal, you should expect one of your children to die. And it provides brilliant evidence that people were just as shocked and saddened then as now. So I'm not saying that's altered. But during this period of acceleration, every year you had more children than older adults because the population, you know, was going worldwide from 1 to 2 billion to 4 billion to 8 billion. There was always a surplus of children and young adults, and that surplus was always going to be bigger in future. And you could do all kinds of things. You could run a pension system on the idea that their work will somehow fund your pension through shares or, you know, that has ended. The vast majority of the future growth of population on the planet, probably to over 9 billion, possibly not to 10, definitely not over 11 billion. That growth isn't new babies. That growth is you and I living far longer than our grandparents did. That's why there'll be more people. We're hanging around for longer. If you double life expectancy in the world, the same number of human beings results in twice as many people at any one time. We are getting fewer and fewer young adults. It will begin to matter. The last time this happened, though, a very long time ago, 1665, with plagues, and then earlier the Black Death. So you have to go back a long time to see social structures altering because of a lack of children and a lack of young adults. But you could begin to grasp that it matters, and we can't carry on treating the young as so disposable, so unimportant, when there are so fewer.
Great, and I'm going to move into a little bit of the questions that have been asked in the chat so far. And one of the questions are, what effect has the pandemic had on the slowdown and our perception of it?
Well, this book, the nice thing about, luckily for me, I made the last changes to the proofs in the first week of January, before hardly anybody had any idea of a pandemic. So the nice thing about the slowdown book is it's an argument about how much we were slowing down anyway, because people think, oh, the reason we have a global recession this year is entirely the pandemic. Whereas most people were saying we're going to get a global recession this year anyway, beforehand. This has an enormous effect on us now because we are incredibly myopic creatures. What's happening right now is the most important thing to us. We don't think of many things at once. And we can come to see now as overimportant. If you try just to remember what were you doing, I don't know, at Christmas, what were you doing 6 months before then? It's quite hard to remember, but at the time, it would have seemed quite important to you. The other thing worth saying is that human beings adapt very quickly. You may have noticed how, you know, I'm now used to the idea that I'm in this house almost all the time, and I can't even go to my work, which is not very far away. And it's rather like how we know we adapted when a war begins. Within a few weeks of a war beginning, people adapt. So my concern, as I said earlier, is that although this seems so terribly important now, as the mortality, and it already is falling everywhere across Europe. Probably 90% of the people who die in my country, which has had arguably the worst pandemic in Europe, 90% are probably already dead, only 10%, hopefully, or less, to die. That will change. It's holding on to this moment and the fear, but also the economic repercussions, and working out good ways out of those. You know, we should now learn that you do not need to fly somewhere to be happy for a holiday. And if it takes us thinking they're going to make me wear a goldfish bowl if I go on a plane, or if I go on that holiday, I might not be allowed to fly back again if something breaks out, you know. So there are a whole set of things that we should learn. I just don't think we should take it for granted that we will. Some countries are better than others at this. It's got to be handed to, you know, Finland has been storing PPE since the 1950s. So some countries, some cultures, some people are better at worrying and remembering than others.
Yes. And hopefully from this, we also know that we don't have to fly into new countries to have conferences and seminars like this, because we can do them digital like we're doing right now.
Absolutely. Certainly for academia. I suspect that the idea of mega conferences of 1,000 or 5,000 people will hopefully go. I mean, they were awful anyway, if you ever attended any of these things. But you know, a small audience, you only need 40 people and a camera. A small audience and a camera. And the amount of time you can save not traveling. That is quite incredible. So this has helped us work out we could do that. But there are things we've also learned, there are things where we do need to actually physically be together. It gets grating after time. You're probably losing concentration now. You know, you've had enough of me. Whereas if you had me physically in a room, it would be easier to bear me waffling on a bit more. And it's working out that difference. There's a lovely story called The Machine Stops. I think I've forgotten the author, but The Machine Stops was a famous science fiction story from over a century ago about when human beings find themselves all living individually in caves on their own. And it was about the fear of that.
Yeah, and you mentioned that us humans, we adapt easily. And one thing that you mentioned that has not slowed down is the global temperatures. So how do you think the slowdown will affect climate change? But also, how can we as human beings affect acceleration and slowdown periods, thinking specifically from an environmental perspective?
I've got four graphs of temperature in the book, because the temperature is complicated. You have to average it and so on, but all four, even one of the graphs is produced by climate change skeptics. But when I draw their data, I even find that shows the temperature rise, you know. And we have to remember as well, it was only 10 or 12 years ago when there was a huge amount of climate skepticism. And part of what got rid of that skepticism was 10 incredibly warm summers, but also generational change. You tend to grow up thinking that what is the major world problem at the time of your teenage years and young adulthood is really important. You know, I will never forget thinking that the most important problem in the world is nuclear war, nuclear weapons, because that was the threat of my teenage years. If you don't tell anybody else, we can share it quietly. The NASA average temperature estimate for February this year was lower than February last year. Now, temperature varies randomly a lot, but you can look up, I think, the March and April figures, and I haven't yet. But this is a relatively small drop in pollution that we've had, and no guarantee that it'll last very long. However, if you can show people and tell people how quickly the air becomes clear, how quickly it is possible to alter things, and how everything doesn't change and get worse necessarily when you do. The other example I can give is the tsunami in Japan. When the tsunami hit, all the nuclear reactors in Japan were turned off. Japan lost about 25% of its electricity production. People thought that life would be terrible, particularly not having air conditioning in the summer to come and not being able to use lifts. In fact, what they did do is turn off a lot of the neon lights in Tokyo. But Japan got through that summer with 25% less electricity production. It is possible to do. We have to. All we've managed to do to date is reduce the average doubling time of our carbon from 22 years to 23 years, right? So if it takes another 24 years to double again, that's kind of game over. So it is obviously a huge problem. And the most depressing graph in my book shows that after each one of those global agreements at Rio and Paris, we actually accelerate our pollution because we think we've done something. So this is the problem of our times. It is as big a problem as imminent nuclear war was in the 1980s. It feels as desperate and impossible as that felt. And yet we got rid of 90% of nuclear weapons. And even today, even with Trump in the White House, we're not petrified by nuclear war because we know there are enough human beings between Trump and the actual button. But it is unlikely. Whereas back then, no. So I have a particular optimism that as long as you can focus and see this as so crucial, then just as past things that seem to be unsolvable have been solved, this will be solvable. But then, of course, there'll be something else that we haven't seen. And the easy way to tell you that is to pass my school exams in geography and to go to university to do geography, I had to write an essay in my 18-year-old school exam about how the planet was cooling down, because that was what was believed to be the truth when I was 18 years old. So we mustn't be too depressed about why didn't we act this faster. We were teaching people not very long ago that we were just about to enter an ice age and we should really worry about it.
And do you think the UN sustainability goals are sufficient to guide the transition that we're facing?
I think they are a good thing. Some people get upset or say that they're not enough, but I have no problem arguing with them. I think the interesting thing is watching those countries on the vanguard who decide to be brave enough to say that they are going to attempt to be carbon neutral by, say, 2025. Who put a little bit more investment into trying to grow meat protein with no meat, without sunlight, these kind of, there's still a space for technological innovation, even if it's slowing down, there still will be innovations. It's just that clearly you want the innovations to be in things that are going to help the planet rather than things that help some billionaire become richer. But the other thing to remember, if you're feeling depressed about this, is so many of us are now being allowed to think, being told we can think, being educated to 18, educated to 21, educated to 22, can read complicated books, can actually understand Wikipedia. Whereas most of our grandparents, even if they'd had Wikipedia, they didn't have the education because they left school, certainly in my case, at 14 or 15, it would have meant nothing to them. That there are some reasons for being optimistic about the situation we find ourselves in. No guarantee that we won't muck it up and we are incapable. There's nothing in our past that says we know how to live sensibly with 8 billion of us without wrecking our home. There's no guarantee. But so many of my students think it's all over. In 12 years, that's the end for climate change. There is no chance of a good future, that the planet should only have 5 billion people on it for some reason, without ever being able to say why they come up with that number 5. There's so much pessimism out there that I do think you need a little bit of looking at actual trends and saying, yes, there are things to really worry about, but it is not necessarily that we are in the end game. And I'll just say one thing about this pandemic. This could have been a worse disease, could have been a far worse disease. The planning was for something like 1918, which, although the best estimates are it killed 17 million people, not 50, but still 17 million in a much smaller world population. This pandemic means that we would have to be doing a very, very bad job not to be prepared for the next diseases which will come. And that sounds like an odd way of being optimistic, but it could have been worse than it is.
Yeah, it really, really could. Now, do you think, or is this slowdown happening everywhere in the world, or is it different in different parts of the world?
It's different in different parts. It is stronger in places like Germany, rural Germany, parts of Italy and Spain, particularly Japan, populations which where you've got quite a lot of very old people, and populations which are no longer growing. There you see that an adaptation to this that is stronger. It is least strong in the rich world, in places like the United Kingdom and the United States, where growth is still seen as really important, the way forward, where we still talk about technological innovation without really thinking about it very much. So ridiculous stories about, you know, what will suddenly happen next with AI, even though we've done this story four times in my lifetime, and so on. Boosterism. So there's a big variation across the rich world, but also, and this is where, you know, what I know is less, but in the poorer countries of the world, you are seeing slowdowns much quicker than I'd assumed, and also changes happening in just one generation that took four generations in the past in the rich country. Brazil, dropping to 1.3, 1.4 children per couple, suddenly. You know, and often complicated reasons as to why, but it's that incredibly fast change in some of the poorest countries in the world that makes me think that pessimism isn't necessarily warranted, because of course people can see people everywhere else. So that changes what happens in poorer places, and what people, particularly young women in poorer countries, demand is very different to what young women in a rich country, when people on average had five children, demanded. And that should give us great scope for optimism.
That's interesting. We're going to wrap up with one last question. So just briefly, in your opinion, what is the worst consequence of the acceleration narrative?
What's the worst confidence of saying, yes, this is Justin Trudeau said this. I think he said it at Davos a year or so ago. Things have never been going as fast as they're going today. But in future, today will appear to be slower than ever, because the future will be. It's the unthinkingness of it. It's the laziness, I think, of carrying on this narrative, then makes me worry about what else we might be missing. You know, I am a worrier, and I kind of think, and it's not just me who's noticed that we're slowing down. Other people have, but you know, it's not that hard once you start looking at some numbers to see it. So I worry about that. The biggest danger, I think, is the idea that we're going to enter some luxury future world where all we have to do is wait for a little bit more technology, and everything will be done for us and we'll be happy. Our houses will be cleaned by robots. Our elderly will be cared for by robots. We'll be able to live a luxury life where we have no responsibilities. It's kind of sometimes called luxury communism. Now, it's great that things are made by robots. I grew up in a town where the most common job was to work in a car factory on a car line. And that car factory still exists in Oxford, where I grew up. But there are now 1,200 robots making electric minis, better than petrol cars, electric minis silently. Right, that's great progress. But I don't want to be looked after in my old age by a robot. human beings are apes. We're used to looking after each other, preening each other, picking fleas off each other, cutting each other's hair. So I think one worry about the acceleration myth is suggesting that we will have some kind of future where A won't exist, but B is not necessarily desirable. Right? This is not what makes us happy as an animal. We are a social animal. We're the most pro-social animal in the world, apart from the naked mole rat. We are designed to be in groups and are happy and get on with that. And we're not going to technologically change our fundamental nature. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, I truly do hope that someone will be picking my hair as I grow older. thank you very much for taking the time, Danny. To all of you that's listening, you will all get a summary on your email. And we will also have another So Talk in 2 weeks, following kind of up on this theme and looking even more concretely on how will this look like. And if you check the box saying that you wanted to get more information on events like this, when you signed up, you will get an invite to this event. So thank you so much, Danny, from joining us from England. And I hope to see you all back here in 2 weeks.
Thank you so much.